Here's a little preview of what we're going to be doing for the remainder of our time. So today, I'm going to introduce a concept known as slow roll eternal inflation. This is going to build on the things that Louis has told you about fluctuations that are produced during inflation. And then I'm going to spend approximately 3 lectures discussing vacuum decay in quantum field theory. So this is another way to get fields to fluctuate, and actually it has to do with non-perturbative effects in quantum field theory instead of perturbative effects like we've been talking about so far. And then I'll discuss another type of eternal inflation that's based on vacuum decay in quantum field theory called false vacuum eternal inflation. I'll spend 1 lecture discussing quantum cosmology, which is trying to define what the wave function or the quantum state of the entire universe could be. And then I'll do 1 lecture in the end. The last class will be sort of recapping and discussing maybe some of the problems with this inflationary paradigm and then some of the alternatives that are discussed in the literature to inflation, where the plural will depend on how long that takes. But you'll get at least 1. OK, so before we jump into it, let's review what we've learned so far, because actually it's pretty incredible. So we have this inflationary paradigm, right, which tells us that if I have some epoch in the early universe which had some scalar field called the inflaton, which sourced some energy density and caused the universe to undergo accelerated expansion, I can take some tiny little patch, which is the size of a sugar cube, basically, and I can inflate that into something that's as big as our observable universe. Okay. Furthermore, we start down here with something that more or less looks homogeneous. And up here, we get something that is more or less, and this could be curved. That's something we learned about. And at late times, we get something that is sort of slightly inhomogeneous, flat. And basically looks like, you know, it produces the right initial conditions for the standard Big Bang cosmology. So the source of those fluctuations was quantum field theory in curved space. So if I have some scalar fields, be it the inflaton or the curvature, as we learned about, then these fields will get fluctuations. And the source of accelerated expansion was the inflaton. So I have some field, okay, it has a potential. And what we learned is that as long as these slow roll parameters are satisfied, slow roll conditions, excuse me, which is that pair of conditions on the potential. So I have this quantity, which has to be much less than 1. And then I have another quantity, which is related to the second derivative of the potential. If these 2 things are less than 1, then I get inflation. Okay, so that means that I get a phase where A, the scale factor in the metric, roughly goes like e to the ht, right? So I get this accelerated expansion of the universe. And I need to make sure that I have enough E folds of inflation to explain the standard cosmological problems, namely that tiny little patch has to get blown up to be as big as our observable universe. That was the horizon problem. And that if there was any initial curvature, I need to make sure it's sufficiently diluted so that I don't see it today, because we don't see it today. And the number of e-folds, you remember, was just given by this integral of h, which is a function of phi of t, dt. And this roughly had to be bigger than 60. Okay. And then we learned about perturbations. And those perturbations were also characterized by the properties of this potential. So to give you a cheat sheet, last time we learned that the amplitude of these fluctuations, p zeta, remember we could always take our full system of the scalar field and the metric and turn that into a single scalar fluctuation and tensor fluctuations. And if I just concentrate on the scalar part, we learn that the power spectrum of zeta, the curvature fluctuation, went something like 1 over 12 pi squared and Planck to the 6 v cubed over v prime squared, where prime means dv d phi. It's written a little bit differently than what we had yesterday, but if you plug in the definition for epsilon and h, this is what you'll get. Okay, so it's just related to the potential and the derivatives of the potential. Another thing that characterizes these fluctuations was the tilt. So that was the fact that this power spectrum is slightly dependent on the value of k that I look at. And by the way, you should evaluate these quantities when phi is at some place on the potential, which corresponds to some k. So if I look at this potential, v of phi, the field being at some position on the potential phi corresponds to a specific value for k. Okay. So basically, as the field rolls down, I sample a range of k. So there's the power spectrum. There's a quantity that tells us about the tilt. So we characterize this by ns. And we learn that this is just given by negative 6 times this epsilon's Laurel parameter plus 2 times this eta's Laurel parameter. Okay, so these are two quantities that characterize the fluctuations. In the tutorial, you learned about tensors. Okay, and the tensor modes, their effect on the spectrum can be quantified by looking at the relative amplitude of the power spectrum for scalar perturbations and the amplitude of power for tensor perturbations. Okay, so tensors are usually quantified in terms of this quantity R, where this is just the power spectrum for tensors divided by the power spectrum for scalars. And this is just 16 times this Laurel parameter, okay? So given that potential, I can calculate the number of e-folds it takes to get inflation to happen, the amplitude, the tilt, the tensors, and this is a fairly good representation of the fluctuation spectrum that I should see in the cosmic microwave background, which is what we use to probe these density fluctuations. So let's talk real quick about that. So we're sitting somewhere in that picture I drew up there. So here I have this constant time surface, and it's full of density fluctuations, okay? And this constant time surface is the surface of last scattering. It's called that because before this time, the universe was basically opaque because it was a plasma, and then the electrons and protons recombined, and the photons that were stuck in that plasma are now allowed to free stream. So this was the last time that they scattered. And I'm sitting here, and I look back, and my past light cone samples some slice through this surface of last scattering. And if I look in some direction, which we'll quantify by some n hat, a unit vector, that's basically just a position, angular position, so some angle theta and some angle phi, then the temperature of the cosmic microwave background, the fluctuations in the temperature of the cosmic microwave background in that direction are given by negative 1/5 times the value of the curvature perturbation evaluated at this point on the surface of last scattering. Okay? So this was the Sachs-Wolf formula that we talked about at the end of the last class. So I just want to say a few more words about that. Before we get to the really wacky stuff. So one thing is that this formula is valid only on really large scales. So usually we write delta t over t as some spherical harmonic decomposition. So I see a spherical sky. Yep.
What do you mean by it's valid only on large scales?
So this is valid for k. Actually, we'll call it the physical wave vector. So the physical, even better, the physical wavelength, okay, bigger than the size of the horizon at last scattering. So I have fluctuations that are much bigger than the causal horizon at last scattering. A number to keep in mind is that the size of a patch on the sky that corresponds to the causal horizon at the time those photons were released is about 1 degree. Okay. So if I look at the CMB sky and I decompose it into these spherical harmonics, then the formulas that we're writing down are valid roughly for angular scales. Bigger than about a degree. Okay. So that corresponds to some range on L, right? Okay, so usually we write the spherical harmonic decomposition where if I look at the expectation value for these ALMs, that's described by this angular power spectrum. So if I figure out the average value of these ALMs, I get some quantification of C sub L. And this P of zeta that we've derived bears on this form for the CLs. So at these large scales, LL plus 1 times C sub L is approximately equal to 2 pi over 25 times this P of zeta evaluated for a K mode, that's roughly given by, if I'm sitting here, I look at the surface of last scattering, it's some distance away from me. The distance it is away from me is roughly 2 times H naught inverse, where H naught is the present day Hubble. And the size of the thing that I probe is roughly the portion of the circumference of the circle, right? Where the angular scale is related to L. Okay. So basically, the K mode that I probe is the inverse distance here on this circle. Okay. So I wanted to mention this because if you've ever opened up a paper on the cosmic microwave background, I'm sure you've seen this truly epochal plot of the angular power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. looks something like that. So show of hands, how many people have ever seen this plot? Okay, good, you're not sleeping. Everyone has seen this plot. So what does all of this tell us about this? Okay. So we have this formula that relates C sub L to the power spectrum. And we know the power spectrum is basically independent of K. So that means a power spectrum which is independent of K will produce a flat line on a plot of L, L plus 1, CL. So when you look at this plot, there's a direct proportionality between P zeta and what you see here. And this is how we constrain models of inflation. This is one of the ways we constrain models of inflation. Okay. So you should know the power you have. If someone gives you some model of inflation, you can test it, and this is how you test it. Okay, so this kind of wraps up what you learned in part one in a nice little package. Everything you need is on these three boards. So before I move on to what's next, are there any questions about that? Yep.
How did you say we can use that part to test it?
Because we measure the value of L, L plus 1, CL at low L. And so I can use this formula to find out what I predict for it, where P zeta is given by that guy right there.
Why do you only want to use low L?
Because we only have 3 weeks, and I'd love to teach you, and Louis and I would love to teach you about how to derive the rest of the power spectrum, but there's simply not time. To get the rest of this, you need to understand what happens at the time of last scattering in that plasma. So that this, basically for L bigger than 10 or so, is not a direct proportionality. It's a more complicated function, which is why you get these interesting acoustic oscillations. Okay, any other questions on this part? Yeah?
I mean, all of the interesting things are not when L is small.
So most of this is not primordial physics. This is interesting physics, but it has to do more with the properties of that plasma and the stuff that the universe is made of than the primordial physics of inflation. So this portion of the angular power spectrum is the most direct test of the idea of inflation, if you will. There really is a direct proportionality between those two things. Well, just to say a few words about that. So this tells you the structure of these peaks is actually what tells you about this cosmic pi. I'm sure you've seen this plot before where we know the universe is roughly 70% dark energy, you know, 26 odd percent dark matter, and then 4% atoms, stuff that we actually see. Okay, so this pi plot can be derived from the structure of these peaks, because depending on what the universe is made out of, the behavior of these fluctuations in that primordial plasma are going to be different. So this is extremely interesting, awesome, great physics. It's just that we don't have enough time to do everything. So I encourage you to take another course on cosmology where I'm sure you'll spend a lot more time in depth on that. Okay, so now let's move on. Let's do something new. So let's step back all the way to the beginning, okay? And let's think about what inflation is actually doing. So we had this initial, let me draw it a little bit bigger. So we had this initial time. We'll call it t equals zero. And we start with some piece of the universe that's undergoing inflation, roughly of the size of a causal horizon. Remember, that's set by h. And so what happens is that this patch basically multiplies itself. So if I look at delta t of about a Hubble time, then for each patch that I start with, I get about 20 patches. That's because the volume is going like what I started with, h to the minus 3 times e to the, okay, now I'm being a dummy, to the 3, because it's a volume. Okay, and this is about 20. So every time I have a Hubble time, I get 20 new patches. Okay, and this keeps happening. So during inflation, you start with one little patch, and you keep dividing. And you make more and more patches. Until from this little patch that I started with, I get something that I actually probe. And at the time inflation ends, the total number of such little patches that I have is roughly h, is basically e to the 3 times the number of e folds, right? So that's if I take the volume that I started with, which was h to the minus 3, and then I divide the volume I end with, which is h to the minus 3 times e to the 3 times the number of e folds. Okay, so we needed about 60 e folds to solve these horizon and flatness, et cetera. So this is a number that's like e to the 180. Okay, that's like a stupendously large number. If you tried to write e to the 180 on a piece of paper, you'd be sitting here for the age of the universe. So this initial patch has divided into this extraordinarily large number of patches. And that's kind of a cartoon picture of what inflation does. So the types of questions that I want to ask amount to, well, that's a picture of what we probe, but inflation is this great multiplier. So could it have multiplied even more and produced regions that we just can't see? So the universe could be much larger than what we see right now. And if I started at some time earlier, then this patch came from the multiplication of another, which came from the multiplication of another, which came from the multiplication of another. So where on earth does that end? Okay, and that's basically the kind of question that we're going to try and address. So where does the madness stop? Or how many patches are there? Okay, so in order to do that, let's look at this a little bit more quantitatively. So we have this branching process, and this whole story here, plus the stuff that you learned about having to do with quantum field theory and curved spacetime, tells us that each of these patches is not completely homogeneous, right? There are these quantum fluctuations which sort of spring to life and become real and imprint themselves in the CMB. So if I had some, whoa, that's super complicated. No. There we go. Okay. Okay, so if I had, so the interpretation was I have these quantum fluctuations, right? So I had phi evaluated at some position, and really what I was doing was taking these quantum expectation values of being in the Bunch-Davies vacuum. So this is something we learned about. And somehow we were claiming in the end that this is equal to some classical expectation value. that is some ensemble. I really have some real ensemble of fluctuations that were sourced by these quantum expectation values, and they were real. There was this quantum to classical transition. And just like Louis, I have nothing to say about that, other than when I have fluctuations that become larger than of order the horizon size, there is some mechanism by which, through decoherence or something else, these quantum fluctuations really turn into classical expectation values of some field that takes different values at different positions. So that means if I had that picture up there of this branching process, and I look at the endpoint at some time, then phi, some field that I have that lives in this space-time, is going to take different values. So if I look at each of these daughters, if I look at each of these branches, then phi is going to take a slightly different value in each place. And the claim is that this ensemble average really means look at the statistics of all the values that phi takes in all of these different little patches. So that's useful to keep in mind. This really equals the expected statistics of phi on some spatial hypersurface. This is really a statement about the statistics of those fluctuations up there, okay, the real fluctuations. So let's now go back to the picture of a massless field in De Sitter space. And there was some interesting quantity that we calculated, which I want to explore in a little bit more depth. Okay, so you'll recall that at some point we wrote down a formula for the two-point function evaluated at the same time, at the same position in space. And this thing we related to the mode functions, and dear God, I hope I got the factor of two convention right. But it looks something like this, okay? Where this, remember, was the solution to the mode functions for phi that we derived, okay? So I have to put some limits of integration in here. And you'll remember that there was some issue with the fact that when k is big, I get this UV divergence, and when k is small, I have an infrared divergence. So the way we're going to deal with this is I'm going to ask a very targeted question. So I only care about the contribution from modes with k less than or equal to h, approximately. Okay. So this means that I only care about the contribution from very long wavelength fluctuations. And if you'll recall, this mode function was made of two pieces. There was this sort of large scale piece and a small scale piece. The small scale piece was what we had in Minkowski space. I don't care about that piece. And so I can rewrite this. Now, I have an upper limit of integration. That's h. Okay. I have this d cubed k over 2 pi cubed. And if you look back, this guy u is u squared is just given by h squared over 2 k cubed. Okay. So we need a lower limit of integration. Okay. And for a lower limit of integration, I'm going to assume that there was some beginning of inflation. So I'm doing this, right? There was some initial patch from whence we came. And for the moment, I don't really care about what came before that. So the contribution from k less than or equal to h and k greater than or approximately equal to some physical momentum, e to the minus ht, where for the physical momentum, I'm going to use h.
A question about addition parameter. After you consider a horizon, horizon crossing modes, these guys are frozen, right? So, shouldn't you make two kinds? So shouldn't you separate it into until the horizon and then the constant modes?
Yeah. So I'm only going to consider modes that are bigger than the horizon. Modes that were basically bigger than the horizon at the beginning, and then subsequently. Okay. So this limit here was the requirement that I only consider modes that are bigger than the horizon in the beginning, and this ensures that I only consider modes that are bigger than the horizon basically always. Okay, so I have some lower limit of integration now, which is h e to the minus ht, and we can do this integral. So we've already done this, but let's do it again. So we can split k, because this only depends on the magnitude of k, into angular directions and then a radius, right? So this turns into, well, I've got a 2 times 2 pi cubed, so we'll pull that out. I've got h, which is constant. I've got a factor of 4 pi from doing the angular integral over k. And then I've got this guy. I've got dk, where that's magnitude k. K squared over k cubed. And that, of course, turns into 1 over k. Okay, so that when I perform this integral, I just get a logarithm. And if you cancel the factors of pi and the 2s and whatnot, what you find is that this quantity is equal to h cubed t divided by 4 pi squared. So the variance in phi evaluated at the same position increases with time. So what the heck does that mean? So if I look at this picture of the branching, I start out with a definite value of phi. That's, say, my boundary condition. I tell you phi is equal to 0 at time equals 0. But then, because of this branching process, and because of the fact that I have different fluctuations in phi that are introduced through the quantum fluctuations, I get a spread of values at some later time. And this two-point function is telling me about the statistics of that spread. So basically, this is like the variance in that spread. So at some later time, you know, if I looked at some constant time slice of the universe, and I carved it up into these cells that are roughly of size H inverse, I'll find a different value of phi in each of these in each of these cells due to the fact that this two-point function is growing, okay? And remember, the only modes that I'm considering because of these restrictions are modes that are fairly long wavelength in comparison to these patches that I have. So if I focus on any given patch, then this just looks like a homogeneous contribution to the field. So this statement here, that I really have these daughters with different values for the field in them, is basically quantitatively encapsulated in this two-point function. OK.
A question?
Yep.
You said that the upper limit came from that we didn't want to include the ones that look like constant space. But I didn't didn't understand the lower limit.
So the lower limit came from considering fluctuations, which are basically only larger wavelength than the size of my initial patch.
Why would we like to do that?
Because I want to be able to specify the value of the field in that initial patch. So, or equivalently, you could say something like, that's the beginning of inflation because I set some boundary condition, which was that I have some field in a particular state that is with a given value at this initial time. Yeah. Okay. So there's another thing to note, which is that I've got all these patches, but they all had slightly different histories. So I could say follow this branch, right? That's one history that if I am just sitting here experiencing inflation, this is what I'd see. I sit at a position, I'm in part of the universe where I double on this side, and then I am in part of the universe where I double on that side, and then I double on that side. And so if I'm sitting here looking at this happen, then what in fact I'll see is a sort of random walk. So I'll see the field really literally fluctuating around me. And there's a nice quantitative way of seeing how this happens, which is encapsulated in this Langevin equation, which I'll tell you about right now. Okay, so many branches means many histories. So if I focus on what's happening for some single observer, right, then remember I'm only keeping these regions which are of order h inverse in size. If I somehow could exist during inflation, which would be really hard because inflation is really high energy and expanding very fast, and I'd probably get ripped apart in many directions, but if I could do that, and I just sat here, and I looked at what happened to phi as a function of time, then I can describe that through a sort of Brownian motion, as I alluded to over here. So I'm at the time of inflation, and therefore, since I have a massless field, I basically always satisfy the slow roll approximation. So usually that would mean this, right? So I just, if I have some constant velocity, I just stay there, okay? So 3h phi dot is zero. That came from the equation of motion for the field where I neglect phi double dot. And usually over here, I've got a v prime, but that's zero because I told you it's a massless field. And what I need to do is I need to add some stochastic piece to this equation. So this is like a noise. That's telling me about these random kicks that I get when I just sit there. Okay? So let's quantify that. Let's see how we get this out. So there's a really easy, if I just rewrite it so it's a bit more clear. This equation has an integral solution. So phi as a function of t due to the presence of this noise is going to be the integral of n of t divided by 3h dt. Okay. And this is really a random stochastic variable because I don't know which particular realization of these quantum fluctuations I'm going to get. I'm going to get some different realization depending on who I am and where I'm sitting. However, because inflation is predictive, okay, there is a well understood meaning for the statistics of this stochastic random noise. In particular, if I look at the ensemble of all the possible histories, the average noise is always zero. Okay. It's because it's a random walk. There's no reason I should get pushed in one direction or another. And we don't have time to show this, but if you calculate the two-point function for phi dot, which tells you about the two-point function for n, you'll find that at time steps bigger than of order h inverse, this is basically uncorrelated. So phi dot kick I get at one time is basically uncorrelated with the phi dot kick I get at a later time. So if I'm only interested in these timescales of order h inverse, then this is basically a Markovian process. Markovian just means the thing that happens at one time is independent of the thing that occurred before. So this two-point function then should reflect that. And there's some complicated prefactor here. Okay, whose amplitude I basically fixed so that we get the right answer in the end. But there is something deeper to that. If you actually did the computation of the two-point function for phi dot, you'd get this out. But let's just see how this works. Okay, so this basically means that's the process is Markovian. Okay, so now I can take this set of trajectories, right? For each realization of the noise, I integrate it and I get a trajectory phi of t. And I really suppose I should put some limits on this so it actually makes sense. Yeah? Go ahead.
So why do you think that the model for your noise is just the random walk? Why don't you have another sources for noise?
So that comes from this statement about the fact that it's Markovian. Okay. So if the kick I get at some later time depended on what happened at a previous time, then I'd have a different form for the two-point function. I can always encapsulate the statistics of this noise as a statement about its moments. So if I know the average, I know the variance, I know the skewness, the kurtosis, you know, all the moments of the probability distribution, that characterizes the noise. Okay. So for a massless field in De Sitter space, if you're more careful than I'm being right now, you'll find that this Markovian property holds. Okay. Further, it's Gaussian. If it wasn't Gaussian, then all these statements we've been making about the fluctuations in the CMB being Gaussian would be false.
Okay. But still, this is assumption.
This is assumption, yeah. You'll see in the end why we make this assumption and why it's nice, because I'll show you that this answer for the two-point function can be gotten through this formalism. So that's where I'm going with this. Did you have a question?
Well, it was that if you could sketch a little bit how to get these correlation functions.
So what we're really doing, like I said over here, is looking at some window around a given position of order size h inverse. Okay. So this quantity phi, if I'm going to be completely honest, phi is really the integral over all space. Actually, we'll call this y. Of some window function times 5y, where this window function basically reflects the fact that I'm looking at this finite size chunk. Okay. And so this equation is really an equation for this average value of phi. Okay. The reason I didn't get too deep into that is that my ambition is only to ask questions about things that are happening on these large scales. Okay. So when I look at the fluctuations in the field, I'm only including the fluctuations that I described above, which are bigger than the horizon always. So if you compute this, which depends on your choice for the window function a little bit, and you find the quantum expectation value for phi dot squared, so phi dot at one time, phi dot at another time, that gives you information about this noise, right? And you'll find this result effectively. Okay, so let's use this and see what we get out in the end. So we can compute the average trajectory. Okay, so I can just pass this ensemble average into the integral. And since the average noise is zero, so is the average phi of t. Simple as that. I can look at the two-point function for trajectories. So what is the correlation between phi at t and phi at t prime? We'll call it t tilde to avoid the confusion with the prime. So I have phi evaluated at two times along this trajectory. And substituting in the definition for phi of t, then this is really just given by an integral from 0 to t, integral from 0 to t tilde. Is given by that. So it just has to do with this two-point correlator for the noise. Yeah? So just as an aside, if any of you ever decide to go into finance, this stochastic calculus formalism will make you millions and millions of dollars. So we have this two-point function, and we know what the correlator for the noise is, so we can just shove that in. So here we're going to get you'll allow me to skip ahead and cancel all the factors of 2 and pi. So I get h cubed over 4 pi squared. And then I've still got this integral 0 to t, 0 to t tilde. But now I have this delta function here. Okay. And if I demand that when I evaluate this correlator, t tilde is bigger than t, then this integral over the delta function just yields t. So this, in fact, is given by this, which should look really familiar to you because that's what we got up there. Okay. So here you see this method of looking at these varied histories in different patches and taking an ensemble average of these different histories gives you the right answer for the two-point correlator for this massless scalar field in De Sitter space. So this ensemble of histories gives you another way of seeing how this two-point function arises. Okay. So if if I were more ambitious, and well, actually, I don't have to be that ambitious at all. I just note the fact that there's no three-point correlator, et cetera, for the noise, that it's really this Gaussian white noise, then I know that phi itself, the distribution of phi itself, has to be a Gaussian as well. Okay. So the probability distribution over histories is just this Gaussian. Where sigma, of course, is phi squared minus phi squared, but that's zero, so it's just expectation value of phi squared. And what does this mean? Well, if I plot phi as a function of t, and let's say that that's zero, then I have sigma above, negative sigma below, and most of these random walk trajectories will be contained in here. Okay, so this gives me some quantification of this random walk. So I can do something else. I can interpret this correlator and this probability distribution as a statement of the behavior of the field at a given time. So these are a whole bunch of histories. And now things are getting a bit messy, so let me redraw this.
Question here, but the correlator depends on time, so it will be broadening, right?
Ah, yeah, thanks. So it broadens linearly in time. But that picture is so messy now that you wouldn't even notice if it did. But yes, you're right, it does broaden in time. Thank you. So now that was done. So I have this branching history. And so following a given set of branches corresponds to getting one of these realizations of phi of t. So that means that rho of phi at this t really tells me something about the distribution of phi in these different boxes. Okay. So there's a few things here. This was just painting, so I didn't really take into account the back reaction of the fact that phi is changing on the geometry, because it was a massless field in De Sitter. Okay. But this is more generally applicable. So I can write down a Langevin equation for a general V of phi, which includes both the fact that the field wants to roll down and the fact that there is this stochastic noise. This is closer to what we learned about the fluctuations produced during inflation. So now I have Hubble, and I have the field equation, right? So again, we work in the slow roll approximation, so we only keep the 3h phi dot, and we ignore the phi double dot. And we're going to allow, when the field fluctuates now, Hubble to change as well. So you can see we've got a potential. So this is going to not be a completely random walk, but it's going to be a biased random walk. And here, the noise, since the noise is now going to depend on the amplitude, right? I wrote up there that this two-point correlator depends on H, and if the field is rolling, H is changing. It's going to be a little bit more convenient to pull out this normalization. So I've got H to the 5/2 as a function of phi over 2 pi. And we're going to multiply this by little n. Where little n averaged is 0, and little n evaluated at t, and t prime is a delta function normalized to 1. So in the homework for this week, you guys are going to analyze v of phi, lambda phi to the 4th, where you can solve this system exactly. And you'll find this probability distribution over trajectories for the biased random walk. OK, so in the last 2 minutes, I get to explain to you what this idea of eternal inflation is. And then we'll pick up the rest next time. But really, we'll pick up the rest next time. Let me allude to it now. So I have this random walk. Right? This is this picture of branching with all these different histories. And let me ask the following question. So in a time delta t, if I look at the two-point function, right? The variance in phi grows by h cubed over 2 pi squared divided by h. So in delta t of order an inverse Hubble, then phi squared is roughly h squared over 2 pi squared. Okay? And if I'm in this sort of 1 sigma realm, then the expected distance that I should move due to this quantum fluctuation is basically the square root of that. Okay? So we'll call it that. Okay? So h over 2 pi. In a time h inverse, the quantum fluctuations will cause the field to move on average a distance of about h over 2 pi. And classically, if I look at the field equation, so I have phi dot, and if I neglect this noise for the moment, I've got negative v prime over 3h, and you know I do something that mathematicians would like eat me alive for, and I just say that this is delta phi and delta t, and then I ask what delta phi is in a time h inverse. I can shove this over here. This is h inverse. That turns that into h squared. And this is the distance the field would move classically, roughly in that same time, h inverse. Okay. We all on board?
What are the indices on delta phi?
Sorry? So this is q for a quantum. Okay, that's due to these fluctuations. And this is cl for classical, just the distance it would have rolled. And I can compare these two things. So you'll note the amplitude of the quantum jumps increases with h, yeah? While the amplitude of the classical roll increases with some combination of v prime and h. And you can get into a case where delta phi quantum is bigger than delta phi classical. Okay? If I go up high enough on the potential, this can happen. If we look at this, you guys can go and derive in three lines that this implies that that this occurs when v to the 3/2 over m Planck cubed is bigger than the magnitude of v prime, okay, the derivative of v with respect to phi. Or, in other words, when if I look at the definition, which unfortunately got erased, of P zeta, you recall that P zeta to the 1/2 power basically was V to the 3/2 over V prime, I believe. Okay. So you'll note that the condition for the quantum fluctuations to dominate the classical jumps basically corresponds to P zeta bigger than 1. So we know that P zeta to the 1/2 in our universe is this magic number 10 to the minus 5. Okay, so this is what we see in the CMB. Yeah. So I'm being sloppy. Sorry. So here we've got mass to the 3/2, mass cubed, and so I need a m Planck cubed. Yeah. Okay. So when this happens, the quantum fluctuations dominate the classical tendency to roll, and I'm basically back to an unbiased random walk. So think about what that means. It's crazy. The field will be rolling up the potential with as much likelihood as it is rolling down. So it kind of forgets about the fact that it's living on a hill. It could go either way. It doesn't really care anymore because these quantum jumps completely swamp this classical tendency of the field to roll. And I'll show you quantitatively at the beginning of the next class that this leads to a phenomenon known as eternal inflation. Okay. That is, somewhere really far away, the universe is still inflating. It's still multiplying. Because there's somewhere in the universe, there's some trajectory where the field just keeps rolling up the hill instead of rolling down. So before we take off, are there any questions on that? I know the last part was a bit fast, but we're going to come back to it and do this quantitatively in the beginning of the next class. No? OK, great. So I'll see you tomorrow.